Thank you, Pierre, for this nice introduction. So indeed, the work that I'd like to present to you this morning was first done in Paris with my colleague, Mathieu Tissier, and concerns a standard family of disordered systems in the presence of a quenched random field. And despite the fact that such models basically have been around for 30 years, I would say that many central questions still remain quite embarrassingly pending concerning these problems. And so the approach we have taken to address these questions actually builds upon both the work on the non-perturbative renormalization group in the formalism of the effective average action that was presented here a couple of weeks ago by Christophe Vetterich, and as Pierre mentioned, to the work on perturbative but functional renormalization group presented here also by Pierre and Kai concerning disordered elastic systems. So some of this here may seem familiar to you or maybe even repetitive, so I would be sorry for that. Anyhow, the outline of the talk will be just a brief review of what's the model, the experimental realizations, and what are the questions we're trying to address here. Why is that an interesting problem? Then a brief recap on the non-perturbative renormalization group for the effective average action for those who missed Christophe's talk. Then how we implement this in the random field ON model, and then the results and the discussion. All right, so let me first brief review of what are the main properties of the random field ON model. So here, for instance, we have the Hamiltonian on the lattice, the dimensional lattice, and with the ferromagnetic nearest neighbor interactions, and the spins are just classical n-component spins, and those spins are coupled to a random field, which is a quenched randomness, and which is, basically defined, that's usually by its two first moments, so we take it with the zero mean and uncorrelated variance, and delta is the strength of the disorder, the strength of the random field. Everywhere here, the over bar will mean an average over the disorder, an average over the quenched random field. Physical realizations, the experimental realizations of this model, mostly in three dimensions, are for n equals 1, the Ising, n equals 2, xy, n equals 3, Heisenberg. And one system that has been very much studied is the dilute antiferromagnet in the uniform magnetic field. But there are also, following a suggestion by Degene actually, quite a bit of study on the near-critical fluids in disordered porous materials, in mesoporous materials. One important problem that I will discuss a little bit, not in detail, but just to see what really happens in the random field version of that, is the elastic glass model for vortex phases in disordered superconductors, something that was on which Pierre and Thierry Jamaki did a lot of work. And then you have other realizations on this, including actually systems where the random anisotropy systems, that is systems where instead of having a coupling, a linear coupling here between the random field and the spin variable, you have in fact, it's bilinear in the spin variable. And in the case where the coupling is weak, in fact, the phenomenology of this random anisotropy model is very similar to that of the random field. But most of the time, I will stick with the, strictly speaking, the random field model. So what are some main properties that are known or accepted about this model? Is that first, the fluctuations induced by the quenched disorder dominate the thermal fluctuations, so that basically the system, as you will see, can be studied at zero temperature. And one example of this very, standard famous example is the Imrie-Ma heuristic argument for checking the stability of the ferromagnetic phase, ferromagnetic order in the system. So basically, here, instead of having the usual heuristic argument when you weigh an entropic contribution and an energetic contribution and, you know, balance those to know whether the order is stable, in that case, the competition is only between energy terms so that you can really work at zero temperature. And the argument goes, you know, it's again very standard, is that you ask in a ferromagnetically ordered, here, up state, you know, what is the cost of creating a domain of size L with the reverse orientation. And of course, the energy cost goes with the interface. So in case of an Ising model, N equals 1, it's just J times L d minus 1. It's L d minus 2 for N larger than 1. And the energy gain is a Zeeman energy, which is related to the fact that you might find some favorable region of random fields. And this goes like delta, the strength of the random field, L to the d 1/2. It's just the large number statistics. And so you can see that ferromagnetic order is then stable for d larger than 2 when n equals 1 in the Ising case, and d larger than 4 when n is larger than 1 for continuous symmetry. Okay, so that's one of the arguments. Now, also going with the dominance of the disorder fluctuations is the scenario that the critical behavior of the system, so between the disordered paramagnetic phase at high temperature, low, high disorder, and the ferromagnetic phase, is in fact controlled by a zero temperature fixed point. So here, if I plot the phase diagram, temperature versus strength of the field, so I have, as I said, high temperature, high disorder, it's a paramagnetic phase. Low temperature, low disorder, it's a ferromagnetic phase, provided that d is larger than 2 for n equals 1, d larger than 4 for n larger than 1. And this is a little flow chart here for renormalization group flow. And what you see that all along the line here of critical points, in fact, the flow goes into a fixed point, which is at zero temperature. So here you have the pure fixed point in the absence, complete absence of random fields, the ordered fixed point, and the fixed point, the random field fixed point, which is at zero temperature. Now, the consequences of that I need to introduce anyhow, is that there is an additional critical exponent compared to the usual ON model for the temperature flow, which is the exponent theta, which is larger than zero because the temperature is irrelevant. It's dangerously irrelevant, but it's relevant. Now, this additional exponent, for instance, enters into the so-called violation of the hyperscaling equation relation between the exponents, and basically tells you that the usual dimension d has to be reduced by this exponent here, theta, in order to recover the usual hyperscaling relation. Other, of course, manifestations of this are the correlation functions, the Green's functions in the system, is that there are two kinds of connected Green functions, because there are two kinds of averages. The brackets here are the thermal averages, and again, the over bar is the average over disorder. And then, you know, we have the usual connected correlation function, which is connected both with respect to thermal average and to disorder average. And this one goes, as usual, to a power at the critical point, of course, to the distance to some power law with an anomalous exponent, eta, as in the ON model. But of course, the new thing is that there is now a correlation function which is disconnected in terms of thermal average, but connected, in fact, in terms of the quenched random field average. And that one has a decay which is much more dramatic in terms, much slower, which is now in terms of an additional exponent, eta bar. So this one is d minus 4 plus eta bar. This one is d minus 2 plus eta. And in fact, those two exponents, eta bar and eta, are related to the exponent theta. So that, you know, introducing theta, eta, and say nu is enough now to describe the scaling behavior of the system. Now, another property of this that I will not really mention, but which is actually a very important one, especially for experimental realizations and what is seen in real life, is that due to this zero temperature fixed point, in fact, there is very slow dynamics of the system. And in particular, the relaxation, the critical slowing down around the critical point is now activated. That is, the relaxation times, instead of being a power law of the correlation length, is now the exponential of a power law of the correlation length. And this leads, of course, to very slow dynamics and hysteresis effect, and which is really seen in experiments. Okay, so let's say that all this scenario is very well supported by many computer simulations.
Gil, is that last point about the dynamics well supported by simulation? Because in general, you might think when it's another exponent, psi, rather than theta, because that time scale grows so rapidly, it'd be very hard to get really good evidence.
Yes, okay, so this, you're right. The fact that this is the exponent theta appearing here is not well supported by, you know, first, of course, simulations for activated dynamic scaling is, there's no way you can access such long times. So basically what simulations qualitatively tells you is that indeed you're activated, but the fact that the exponent is theta is not psi, which would be a new exponent, a new dynamic exponent, is not known. So you're right. This point is not verified in the case of the random field model. Absolutely right. Okay, so what are now the open questions on top of what that Mike mentioned?
Did you establish that there are only impermanent phase?
No, I will come to this point. I'm just specifically now, I was discussing what is the main accepted features, but no, we'll see that there is another possibility, of course, in the game. What are the open questions? So the first one is related to the critical behavior of the system. Just simple paramagnetic to ferromagnetic, and it goes to what is named as the dimensional reduction problem, something also that occurs in disordered elastic systems. And what happens is well known is that you do standard perturbation theory to all orders, or if you want to have a more elegant approach, you do the Parity-Soulas supersymmetry trick to treat this problem, and you predict that the critical behavior of the random field O(n) model in dimension d is exactly the same as the critical behavior of the pure O(n) model in dimension d minus 2. So there is this dimensional reduction d to d minus 2, which is equivalent to saying that the temperature exponent theta is always equal to 2, the one that enters, for instance, in the hyperscaling relation. So this is a very nice prediction, but in fact it is wrong, and it contradicts the Imrima argument. So we could say, hey, okay, but the Imrima argument is heuristic, so you know it can be wrong when you do hand-waving arguments. Okay. But in fact, it also contradicts exact results about the lower critical dimensions of the system. So for instance, you know, for the Ising model, if the reduction is by 2, you would expect the lower critical dimension, which is 3, so you would expect no phase transition in 3 dimensions. And in fact, it's been shown that there are phase transitions in 3, that the lower critical dimension is 2 and not 3, just as predicted, in fact, by the Imrima argument. So dimensional reduction is wrong. And from the interest actually of the supersymmetric version of that is that one knows, can get a feeling that this is due to the presence of multiple metastable states. So that might sound familiar because something that Pierre and Kai probably introduced in their talks. And of course, metastable states that become dangerous here because remember the fixed point is at zero temperature. So basically there's no escape from the metastable states except we just have to weigh them in clever fashions. Okay, so that's the first problem, which is, you know, how do you get out basically of dimensional reduction in this problem? The first one goes to what was asked is the what's the phase diagram in the whole plane number of components of spins of the spin vectors and dimension, spatial dimension. So the paramagnetic transition, as I said, is for d larger than 2 for n equals 1, d larger than 4 for n larger than 1. But precisely as Marcus asked, it's possible to have also a quasi-long range order phase, that is a phase where the order parameter is vanishes, but where the correlations still decay with the power law fashion in terms of the distance. And that could occur for dimension less than 4, and of course for spins with the continuous symmetry, for n larger than 1. And one problem here, because this is of course in the region of interest, three-dimensional cases for condensed matter physics, is in particular, is there such a phase in the case of the XY model, n equals 2 and d equals 3, which is a phase with quasi-Lagrange order, so power law decaying correlations that Pierre and Thierry called the Bragg-Glass phase. So is there a phase in the random field, such a phase in the random field XY model? Now let me summarize this and what we know about the problem in this phase, you know, in this kind of diagram. So n infinity is here. I'm sorry, it's not a very good representation of infinite, but okay, you know, I hope I put quotes, so I hope that you will forgive me. So the number of components and dimensions. So what we know about this problem is that first the upper critical dimension above which you get classical mean field behavior is 6. And the displacement for 4 to 6 in that case corresponds to dimensional reduction by 2. So that works. Basically dimensional reduction is okay around 6. Now below 4 we know that there is no ferromagnetic transition. Now there's a proof also by Feldman that there is also below 4 and for n larger than 3, strictly larger than 3, there is no quasi-Lagrange order either. So this thing here we know there's no transition. Now here we know that there is ferromagnetism, or along the Ising case even down to d equals 2, but of course the question is what's happening in this region, what's happening in this regions in terms of a phase diagram. What we know also is that for n infinite, so the large n limit at dominant behavior, nothing special happened. That is, there is dimensional reduction. So dimensional reduction is obeyed for n infinite, like for d equals 6 or larger in a way. Around this, if you do perturbation theory, based in 1 over n or in epsilon equals 6 minus d, basically you no conclusive result has been reached. And in fact, the dimensional reduction fixed point, the one that gives back that dimensional reduction, is still present in that case. So you see, you start from a side where the system has that, you know, dimensional reduction property for the transition, the critical point. And the interesting new information was actually due to Daniel Fisher and then by Feldman a little later, is using the perturbative functional renormalization group around the lower critical dimension of the system for, of course, n larger than 1. So in 4 plus epsilon. And then, of course, you use the nonlinear sigma model, and Fisher worked the equation to one loop. And Feldman found that for n equals 3, 4, 5, you just solve the equation, he found in that case the same thing as the disordered elastic systems. That is, the renormalized effective action becomes, in fact, non-analytic. And you know, it has a cusp. And it's this cusp that, in fact, leads to a breakdown of dimensional reduction. So basically, if we think of this diagram, you know, here you have the transition with the breakdown of dimensional reduction. Here you have, and all here, you have dimensional reduction. So, of course, the question is what happens in the middle? And again, the second question is about quasi-Lagrange order in this region here. So the idea now is based on this picture is that we wanted to get clearly the resolution of the problem, you know, seems to require some kind of unified description of the whole plane ND. Just because you want things here in the middle and you want things here in the middle, where you do not access by perturbative theory.
Is that a question? The Altman work is one loop order?
Yes. Okay. Yes. It's exact. He took the Fisher equation. Fisher at that time, you know, basically it was his work that he did before working on depinning and all these transitions. And he didn't look for non-analytic solution. He realized that the analytic fixed point was no longer stable, but he didn't look for analytic non-analytic solutions, and Feldman just did it later. So
when you say for Wiesner and for an n larger plane field there are no transitions, and due to Feldman, this is also the perturbative work?
No. This is rigorous result. Yeah. This is rigorous result in that case. You know, it seems obvious, of course, why I plot this diagram, that we need a unified description to get here in the middle and get here in the physical region. And the idea to do that, as I said in the very beginning, is in fact to combine the perturbative functional renormalization group, as, you know, was first here developed by Fisher and then worked out in great detail for other systems, and the non-perturbative or exact renormalization group as was presented by Christoph Witterich. So that's why we coined some kind of weird name, which is the non-perturbative functional renormalization group. I'll say why it's what? You mean here? Yes. I'm sorry. Here in the pinky region here. So with the one loop on this side, you get quasi-Lagrange order. Okay. So here you get on this side the one loop gives you ferromagnetic ordering, and on this side, I'm sorry, you get quasi-Lagrange order. So there is a hint, of course, that this region here has quasi-Lagrange order. Of course, no ferromagnetic order, but quasi-Lagrange order. And that ferromagnetic order is only on this side. But you're absolutely right.
Quasi-Lagrange order appears for every n or only for n equals 2 for dimensions smaller than 4?
We'll see this, but it's actually it appears only, you'll see, below some critical value. And then there's a, well, that's part of the of what we showed. There's a lower critical dimension also for that. So that's, I guess, the introduction of, you know, why we are interested in this problem. And now I'll just give you a fast recap on what Christoph Witterich probably told you a couple of weeks ago. But I guess, you know, for completeness, I have to do this. Again, the whole framework will be that non-perturbative exact renormalization group and in the formalism as of the effective average action. And the idea is that we want to build something like an effective action or, say, a Gibbs free energy in the case of course, magnetic system at a running scale k. And that quantity is built by including, you know, it's the whole RG idea, continuous RG idea, including fluctuations with momenta larger than k. And that quantity will then interpolate, if it's well done, between at the microscopic scale, just the microscopic action, so it gets the microscopic physics here, and when you have done the full inclusion of fluctuations, of course, is just the effective action, the real one, or the true Gibbs free energy, not just the energy at scale k, that gives you the whole physics of the problem and the thermodynamics and the correlations and all you need. And in order to do that and to separate the modes with momentum larger or smaller than the scale k, the idea is to add to modify the action by adding some kind of scale-dependent mass term in the form of a quadratic term here with an infrared cutoff function that, again, here it's plotted versus the square of the momentum, that gives a mass to the modes with low momentum, so prevents basically the integration over those modes, and basically, you know, has zero mass for the modes of higher momenta, so allow full integration over those modes. And the properties of this function, that of course may be chosen otherwise, you know, with a great deal of freedom, is that this function, you want it to go to zero when k goes to zero, because you want to recover the effective action with all modes integrated. And when you get to the microscopic scale, you know, lambda or infinite if you're not too picky about the microscopic details, then you want this function, this cutoff function, to be infinite, because then that's what prevents any kind of integration and gives you back the microscopic action. So otherwise, you know, pretty much freedom. And in fact, you can, you know, it's both, I think, something bad, which means that, of course, then if you choose one action, one cutoff or another in specific approximations, you will get different results. But it's also a way then to check, you know, the validity and optimize your results in those cases. Of course, in the exact scheme, you can take any cutoff you want. I mean, the result is completely cutoff independent. But again, we'll have to do approximations. One simple that I mentioned here, because this is actually the one we've used, simple case is that instead of having that, it's been introduced by Litim, is the something which is just linear here, and then has a Heaviside function, so it's zero above. So it's good enough in terms of derivative properties for the derivative, and makes life easier for computing the integral, the loop integrals in a way. Okay, so with this mass term, then you introduce a modified partition function, okay, with the sources, and adding this term. And then by simple Lejeune transform of the log of the partition function and the free energy, that's how you get the effective average action, which now depends on the order parameter field. And that effective average action is now the generative functional of the one particle irreducible correlation functions. Okay, so that's the way to build it. And it's easy to show now by using formally all this, that there is now an exact RG flow equation for the evolution of this effective average action with the running scale, and that's the flow equation that I'm writing here. So the evolution of this function here is just given by, here is the derivative of the cutoff function. The trace is just the integral over momenta or other components, and you have to the inverse here of the something which looks like a modified propagator, and gamma 2 is the second functional derivative of the action itself. So it's a functional differential equation for this action, effective action. Now, the point is that, of course, it needs approximations because you can't solve it, and one of the most popular one is the so-called derivative expansion that I'll give slightly more about this.
Here you chose a step function for RK,
you get the hard cutoff result. Oh no, even here you can get the perturbative. I'll show that you can get the here too. I mean, of course, the perturbative result is included in here. It has the form of a one loop expression, but then of course if you do perturbation in terms, expand gamma in terms of perturbation, then you recover exactly the results of the perturbation theories. I mean, it's exact, so it's included in the problem. But I'll show maybe slightly more about this, how you get the results.
It's possible it's exact for two particle properties, which is all you need, but not necessarily exact for other quantities.
Well, it's exact. I mean, why would you only for two particle quantities? You know, it's a functional in that case. You know, it's pretty, in a way, it's pretty useless, right? Because it's so general that It's exact but very general. So this is a functional of the fields here, and of course then if you want to make this for uniform fields instead of just fields that vary everywhere, then you have to consider a whole hierarchy of equations. Then you have one for the second derivative that will involve the third and the fourth derivative, and then and so on and so forth. It's just because here it's written in, as a level of a functional. I mean, the good aspect of it is that it's physically quite intuitive. You know, if you forget all these details, of course, that are, you know, related to the functional, and it gives some idea about what kind of approximation, some guidance about what kind of approximation could be used for the problem one has at hand. All right. So a little bit more now on how we implement this for the random field O(n) model. So that will go fast because we start again from the microscopic action. So now it's soft spin, continuum, Ginzburg-Landau type description with a coupling, so phi-4 theories with a coupling to a random field, which is again Gaussian and uncorrelated. Delta, as usual, as I said, is the variance of the random fields. Again, we face the problem that we have to average over a disorder, over the quenched disorder. And we're using here, but there are other ways to do it in that case, you know, the infamous replica trick, where so we replicate the system in order to get a homogeneous system on which we can explicitly perform the average over disorders.
What are the practical tools would you consider replacing the replica trick?
Now, okay, it's been done, for instance, for disordered elastic system. So you can use the dynamic formalism in that case, where you can just average the disorder because you can use, if you're at zero temperature, and that's what we did it in this case, you can use also the supersymmetric trick at zero temperature, the Parisi-Sourlas trick, and then you do the average without having to introduce replicas with number of replicas going to zero. So that's the two cases, and it's been shown also by Kai in the case of the disordered elastic systems that you get, you know, by using all these techniques, you get the same result. I guess also that one can work probably directly with the probability distribution of the disorder, but that would be a real mess, I think.
You use the Parisi-Sourlas argument, which gives you actually dimensional reduction. When it overcomes dimensional reduction, you do a functional version of that.
Yeah, because in that case, all right, in that case, what you have to do, in fact, is consider not replicas, I would say, but copies of the same system.
How many?
Well, you know, if you want, okay, and I haven't introduced it here, but if you want something like the second cumulant of the renormalized disorder, you need two copies. If you want the third cumulant, you would need three copies, and so on and so forth. Now, the number of copies, of course, doesn't go to zero now. It's one or two or three. And then it's a question of, you know, analyticity of the when okay. But it's much, I must say, it's much messier to do it that way in that case than it is for the disordered elastic system, because in the disordered elastic system, basically, the pure theory is free, it's a Gaussian theory, so everything is much, much easier. Pardon me? That's right. But we don't do perturbative calculations. No, I don't think so, actually. Well, you have to make... it has to be, you know, I can't go into the detail, but you have to make sure that the truncations satisfy all properties at all times. So, but provided you do that, we have checked, for instance, that the truncation, one of the truncation we're using with the derivative expansion and stuff like this, is indeed the same, get the same result as the supersymmetric version of it. So we have checked this. We have one check of this. Okay, so, but this is, I must say that the replica formalism is pretty convenient. But we're using it, again, like for disordered elastic systems. With what we're going to do is by building now the modified partition function, which has both, again, an additional mass term, infrared mass term, and coupling two sources, but we're putting sources that are different on all replicas. So we don't want any kind of spontaneous symmetry breaking, funny things and all. I mean, really, the replicas have an explicit symmetry breaking, so that basically many of the properties will be on much safer ground in this case than usual. Okay, so we add now, again, mass term, as I said. We do the Legendre transform, and that gives us a replicated, in a way, effective average action.
What is the structure in the AB indices of this matrix?
This one?
Yeah.
Oh, so it has to be replica symmetric, okay, because only the sources are breaking the symmetry.
It's any replica symmetric.
So, yeah, it's any replica.
Two components.
Yes, well, it turns out, in fact, that the underlying supersymmetry constrains what you should choose in terms of the part which is diagonal and the part which is not diagonal. So, that's the only constraint, basically.
Why should there be a coupling or a mass term in the offhand?
I don't know if I want really to answer this, because in the whole following, I won't put any coupling between the off-diagonal terms. Okay. The point is that if you want to satisfy, you know, okay. One of the nice aspects of this formalism is that provided this mass term satisfies all the symmetries of the problem, so here, you know, we could have the On symmetry. Well, I've done it for n equals 1, but you could have the On symmetry, or you can have here, of course, as I said, you need the replica symmetry in the absence of sources, so that's easily implemented, and then the replicated effective average action has the right symmetries of the problem. So this is perfect. Now, the slight problem is the underlying supersymmetry. Of course, we might not take it seriously because we know it's broken anyhow, so who really cares about it? But if we really want to have it, then you see the underlying supersymmetry is not obvious to see at the level of the effective average action, because it's not just the same fields, the same variables. But when you do that, actually, you can show that it's important to keep an off-diagonal term, although we don't keep it. Okay, now, I mean, the work is in progress to solve the equation with it. But in that first approach that I will show, we don't keep it. So the only reason to keep an off-diagonal term is because you want in some regions of the diagram to be supersymmetric. That's all.
Just to make sure I understand, so this breaks the On symmetry explicitly?
No, it doesn't break the On symmetry. It is, I'm sorry, I was not maybe clear enough. This, you know, it's written here for the Z2 symmetry, so it is, or in On will be general. So this function does not break the On symmetry and does not break the replica symmetry. So those symmetries are symmetries then of the effective average action. We want to make sure of that. That's easy to implement. The only one which is, as I said, not easy is the supersymmetry, which is anyhow broken. Okay, so we have
transforms as a tensor on the O-N, that's what you're saying. The A and the B is the transform.
Oh, because no, I didn't write, you know, I'm sorry, I just, you know, I was kind of lousy here. Didn't want to put all indices and all. So this is only for the n equals 1. So the indices here are the replica indices.
So
I'm sorry. Of course, you'd need On indices, the n vector indices, and get the right tensorial content here. Yes. So as you then we get, you know, same thing, a flow equation for a functional, which is now a functional of course, the n replica fields. So this is even, you know, harder to solve if possible as before. And the indices, now this is of course a matrix also in replica indices, and that the trace is the integral over internal momentum plus sum over replica indices plus, if the On model, sum over n vector components. So we need approximations. Now the first one, which is, you know, the standard one in this kind of in a kind of non-perturbative approaches, was discussed by Christophe, is the derivative expansion. That is, we are interested by long-distance physics around phases that are basically uniform, so we expand in basically derivatives, spatial derivatives of the fields, and we truncate, you know, we don't want to go too far, it's already a big mess before. So you truncate at the just second derivative level, which has been tested as being giving good results in the case of the ON models and many other models. So that's the first kind of approximation. But that's not enough in our case, because of course everything here is a function of the N replica fields. So we have to handle this. That's the what is specific in this problem. And to do that, we use the same trick as for the disordered elastic systems. That is, we expand in the number of free replica sums. So that's a weird concept. But say for the potential, for the local part, which depends on the N replica fields, the idea is to expand into a part which depends only on one replica field, of course, summed over, that's a free sum, because it has no constraint on the replicas here. A part, the minus sign is just for convenience, a part then that depends on two replica fields with no constraint on the sum, a part which depends on three replica fields with no constraint on the sum, and so on and so forth. So it's an expansion in the number of free replica sums. And, well, of course, if everything is replica symmetric and n goes to zero, that one is proportional to n, that one to n squared, that one to n cubed, and so on and so forth. So it's an expansion in n. But of course, it's not exactly what we want here. And in fact, the idea is, which can be seen very clearly in the case of disordered elastic systems, it's a little more tricky here, is that basically those functions U, V, W, which are symmetric, continuous functions of the arguments, are somewhat the moments or the cumulants of the renormalized random potential which you generate along the flow starting from a random field. So you start from a random field, which is just simply a pair term, actually. It's just delta phi A phi B summed over AB. And of course, along the renormalization flow, what you will do is induce random and isotropies of all kinds and induce the full random potential. Now, the full random potential now, basically what this will do is that will give you access, since now I have it's purely local, to the local part of the cumulants of this random potential. And that you can see also actually by working the supersymmetric version of this. And all this is you know, very well presented, discussed in all the papers by Pierre and Kai. Although here again, there are some subtleties related to the fact that the one replica part gives the thermodynamics of the system, and here is of course highly non-trivial, because you know there's a two-phase transition ferromagnetic to paramagnetic or quasi-Lagrange order, and so on and so forth. Now, just to give the example, of course you can play this game now for matrices. And expand also in free replica sums. There's some little trick to get out the Kronecker symbols, and you could do it also for higher order tensors of the replica indices. And all this again has been worked out by Pierre and Kai in some detail. Now, the last type of approximation that one has to do, and so this one is very conventional. In studies on non-perturbative truncations, is if needed, just because otherwise the equations are completely intractable, one expand around in fields, you know, with powers of the fields. But the clever way to do it, which converges much better, is to expand around the field configuration that minimizes the potential, and in that case, which minimizes the one replica potential. So we'll have to resort to that kind of also of approximation. So that's the approximation scheme, and of course you can go, you know, you start from what you think is the lowest order having all necessary ingredients, and you can work up the ladder and improve your approximations if needed. But here it's, since things are functional, it's at the cost of really heavy problems in solving the equations. Okay, so this is the minimum truncation And I will say briefly why it is indeed the it has the necessary ingredients. So in that case, we just keep one renormalization of the field, you know, which will give us, which is computed at the minimum, and which will give us the anomalous dimension. We don't take off diagonal terms for the derivatives. We take the one replica part, again, that gives us the thermodynamics of the system, and we take the two replica part, which gives us the second cumulant of the disorder. It's something which generalizes the variance of the random field. And we truncate, you know, everything else. And as I said, in this work, we choose a diagonal cutoff function with the cutoff that I, the function that I showed earlier. Now, it's easy to see that there's an exact equation of flow for gamma, the effective average action. Then you insert the ansatz in that and gives the prescription for computing now the flow equations for the function uk, the function of two variable vk, and the constant zk, which gives the renormalization of the flow. And using all that, you get then your coupled flow equations that are closed, consistent equations for this. Okay, so that's the idea. The one next step is very brief again, is that of course we're looking for fixed points. So this is our first interest. And so we want to use dimensionless renormalized quantities. So there's a little more work again to do here because we're starting with the Ginzburg-Landau version of it. So we have, say, standard dimensions for the potentials, for the field with the anomalous dimension of the field. But that's not enough because remember that the fixed point we're looking at, the putative fixed point, is at zero temperature. And there's no temperature here in the Ginzburg-Landau version of it. So we have to introduce an explicit measure, basically, of the temperature, an explicit renormalized temperature. There are, you know, different ways to do it that asymptotically should give the same answer. And we define, basically, the temperature, renormalized temperature, that way, which is the kinetic term divided by the disorder term, delta being the renormalized strength, if you want, if you wish, of the random field. So in that case, it's a whole function here. But we consider the function only at the minimum. So that's a definition of an running of an renormalized temperature. And it's easy to show, of course, that temperature is equal to the bare temperature, to the normal temperature of the system at the microscopic scale. And from that, one can define the temperature exponent theta and the relation and with the other exponents.
You don't add a coupling in the action for the temperature?
Well, the temperature here is defined in terms of already known quantities.
So there's no additional,
you're not introducing, if you want to solve the equations without introducing dimensionless quantities, you wouldn't even see that problem. So it's just a convenient way to find the fixed point. And of course, if we had done this bad, then we wouldn't find any fixed point in the problem.
That's right.
Okay, and so we define, you know, in lowercase some now renormalized dimensionless quantities, and with that, then we have our flow equations. I won't give them to you, but just to see how they look like. Let me just look at this one. Okay, so this is the kind, I'll just flash this. Okay, this is the kind of flow equation that one gets here. And of course, the infrared cutoff function now and the integral over momentum, remember that looked like a one loop equation, are just hidden in those so-called, you know, threshold functions that do the integral here. And basically, for instance, in our case of cutoff function, you know, this has an analytic form, which is nice. And the interest of these cutoff functions is that first, it's non-polynomial, so it carries some of the non-perturbative physics in it. And second, as we need, it helps to basically decouple massive modes from non-massive modes. So in particular, that's important to get to go back to the nonlinear sigma model around the lower critical dimension. So the properties of those threshold functions are important for that. And what we can see here is that there's a term which goes like the renormalized temperature, and of course, if the exponent indeed is larger than zero, then the fixed point is at zero temperature as expected. So we can work directly at zero temperature. Okay, and this can be generalized to the ON.
What is the notation?
So the notation is what I just flashed before, is that UK is the dimensionless renormalized, one replica potential. So it's the part which depends on one replica. So it's a function of one field. So UK depends on one field. VK here depends on two fields. It's the two replica part. And then we have the anomalous dimension. So basically, we have one equation for one function of one variable, one equation for one function of two variables, and one equation for one constant. Okay, that's, and everything that is coupled. And for the ON model, it's a little more complicated, of course, because we have one more variable due to the ON invariance.
But VK does not appear in the for UK. So
no, it does. It does. It does. Okay, because in the non-trivial part, you have the delta K, which is, again, the second derivative of V, and which is the renormalized strength of the disorder. Of course it does. I mean, that's precisely the term, which is all the equations are coupled. But for instance, if you take the equation for that guy, just that one, I didn't write everything here. So you have one piece, which is, I would say, the regular one. That is the one that you would get by considering here the fields are equal. And consider that the fields are equal from the beginning. Basically, you get only that result here. And that's the result that you would get from perturbation theory, from the supersymmetry result, assuming that everything is analytic in the problem when the fields becomes equal. But then you can see that in fact in the equations you have two additional terms, anomalous terms in a way, that involves the way you take the limit when the two fields become equal on these functions. And of course those terms are zero if the function is analytic when phi prime is goes to phi. But they are non-zero, that one is non-zero, if there is a cusp in the system, that is, if there is a term which goes like the phi prime minus phi, the absolute value of it, because it has to be an even function of phi prime minus phi. So what we see from this is that basically the only way to avoid the standard fixed point with dimensional reduction is that one needs a cusp, a singularity, in the renormalized cumulant of the field or a quench field or the disorder, a linear cusp, just the same as in the disordered elastic systems. And of course, that should occur when the renormalized temperature is zero, because otherwise, if that's not the case, then you can see that you do not reach a fixed point, because this term then blows up. And in fact, what happens, again, just exactly like in the disordered elastic systems, is that the limit of zero temperature at the end of the flow is approached in a non-uniform way, and there's a boundary layer and all this and all that. But I won't discuss this in detail. This is very much similar to what probably Pierre and Kai mentioned.
So the nature of the cusp, is it modified by the Lambda-Ginzburg interaction or not?
There is a coupling, yes, between the one replica part, which is now non-trivial, and gives you the thermodynamics and the cusp, which is related to the two replica part. Yeah. So this is modified. But the fact is that to get out of dimensional reduction, you get a linear cusp, and that's the same property as in the disordered elastic system.
But you still get the linear cusp.
Just
yes.
Coefficients.
Pardon me?
Just coefficients which are changed.
Just, okay.
Well, coefficients are functions, in fact, because yes. In that case, it's two functions, right? So, well, in the Ising case, you have phi primes, you have two fields, and of course, the cusp is only in the difference between phi prime minus phi. And of course, in fact, the cusp is now a function of the other variable, which is phi prime plus phi. So it's not only a coefficient in a way, it's a whole function that goes with the cusp.
In fact, in your formula, in this formula, you found the circus, which don't seem.
Yes, if I have a little time, I just... zoom fast, and it goes to, you know, how we can make sure that kind of approximation is not completely, you know, out in the blue, is that this approximation becomes exact in some limits. It gives back the large n limit at leading order, which is good, and it gives back, you know, it's fairly easy to show, the first order in the expansion around the upper critical dimension at one loop. So that's, it recovers exactly this. And the second and more important thing, and of course that's where the choice of the truncation is important, is that it's not completely trivial to show, but it can be shown, that in fact it gives back the functional RG equation that was derived by Daniel Fisher at one loop around the lower critical dimension now. So this equation that I wrote, all those flow equations, contain all those one loop results, including the perturbative functional renormalization group at one loop. Okay, so in a way, you know, and this is independent of the choice in that case of the cutoff. So in a way, we can think of this, you know, to the least, as, you know, a kind of consistent interpolation in the whole plane of number of components dimension that allow you to really study the whole plane, things that you cannot do with the perturbative approaches. But at least it. You can, but you have to go to many loops. Here we go directly to the solution of you know, if you start from 6, going to 3 is kind of a long way. If you start from 4, going to 5 is a... Well, but this is, the 2 is implicit in here. There's how maybe we can discuss this. So it's, of course, exact at one loop, but it has an approximate two-loop result. And in fact, as we know because we worked on that, in fact, the scenario of the two-loop perturbative functional RG is, you know, very similar to the one that we get from the non-perturbative description, despite the fact, of course, that in this case, the coefficients are not exactly the same. But the physics, in fact, is the same. Okay, so we solved these flow equations, and now I'm going to just go rapidly to the results now, because it's getting late. So the first point is that the analytic fixed point is never stable in the problem, except, again, as I said, when n is infinite or d is larger than its upper critical dimension. It's never stable. That means that the stable, or the once unstable, because it's the critical problem, is non-analytic everywhere in the variable, as I said, which is the difference of the fields, not the vectors, in the case of the ON. But the non-analyticity, which is zero in this case here, becomes actually stronger as the dimension decreases and the number of components decreases. And in fact, it's only when this non-analyticity is strong enough that it's a linear cusp that you see, you know, I'll show you just a thing, that you see, for instance, in the fact that the effective curvature, in a way, goes to infinity. Only when you have a linear cusp in the problem does the critical exponent, as I showed from the equation before, differ from their dimensional reduction value. So that, if, in fact, in the whole plane, ND plane, the relevant fixed point is never analytic, but it has weak analyticity in most of places, sub-cusp, or sub-cusp, and so on and so forth, which, of course, will change some of the you know, exponents, eigenvalues that are associated with some irrelevant operators, but do not change the main critical exponents, those associated with the leading scaling behavior. So the fact that, you know, C, for instance, something that diverges, so this is the kind of result that we get along the flow, so that's the effective curvature as a function of the flow time here. And you see that in dimension 4.5, and basically what you have when you see this is that when you're above some critical value of the number of components, you know, nothing happened. The thing goes to a fixed point, which is you know, just has a finite value. When you are below some critical value, which is around 12 here, then you get a divergence of this value, which is signal the fact that now you have a non-analytic behavior. You have a cusp in the system, and you can follow then the cusp in the system. I have a picture of this, but I'm not sure it's very illuminating for you. So the result is this kind of diagram now, which is that dimension, number of components, is that in fact there is a critical line above which, again, the main exponents related to scaling are given by dimensional reduction, and below which there is a breakdown of dimensional reduction, and indeed, in that case, you are compatible with all the exact results. And you know, this line here is, you know, goes around 5 for the Ising model, and in 4 plus epsilon you can show that's an exact result, that it's n equals to 18 in that case. So that's the first result, okay? And the cusp is just present here, and above here it's subcusp. And the physics of the cusp I don't discuss, but it's very much related to what Pierre and Kai have already said.
Results are controlled by small parameter near 4 dimensions. Beyond, they are not, or are they also controlled?
Okay, so that's a good discussion about are the results controlled or uncontrolled. The results are somewhat uncontrolled, in a sense that in terms of a small parameter, we have it here in 6 minus epsilon and infinite and 4 plus epsilon. So here it's controlled at one loop, in a way. Right. Now, at two loops, since both of us did the calculations, at two loops, the result then is no longer exact. So, and that's what I was saying, that there's a quantitative difference, but you know, the slope at two loops is something like this that you can check. So there is a quantitative difference, but the physics is here. And of course, since you know here, you know, at two loops, the result in here wouldn't be meaningful. So you would have to go to 4 loops or 5 loops. So at least we have a result here. Now, you cannot be sure. The only way to check this line is to improve, basically, the truncation. And again, this is what we are doing now with an improved truncation to get a better description of this line. But, you know, there's little doubt that it will be in that region, no doubt that it will be in that region.
You don't know what happens for D equals 5 in that regime, how the line means, how it goes actually.
Well, you know, again, that will, you know, whether it's here or here, we really don't know. I mean, this has to be checked. Well, we don't know. We have to improve the truncation. And this is something that we are doing now, is check, you know, how this point varies here.
But it doesn't go to 6 dimensions.
Oh, no, it doesn't go to 6. That's for sure. That's and we understand why. I mean, here we understand why the cusp, the subcusp, you know, why it goes down and why it becomes stronger and stronger as you approach this. So, yeah. Okay, so last...
Does the cusp develop after finite argument?
Yes. As I showed in the previous... slide, yes, it develops. It's at zero temperature, okay? At zero temperature, it develops at a finite scale, which is this scale here. And beyond that, the action, the effective action becomes, or the two-field, two-replica correlator becomes, has a cusp. So, yeah.
It's surprising. I mean, often you might say that after a finite RG player, you're dealing with something that's like a finite size system, and you wouldn't expect it.
Well, it's, you know, it's in the case of the disordered, in the case of the disordered elastic systems, it's just the locking length. Right, so it's something that you expect, that that it gives you a typical length scale, you know, and basically above which you have the metastable states become important. Now, in the case of the random field, it's slightly harder to make a good phenomenological description of what really this length mean, but it's the length above which basically metastable states become important in computing the correlations of the system.
But I think the point is that when you interact for nodes, you have the minimization because you're at zero temperature, and there's no natural
physical. It's because you're.
It's not really.
Oh yeah, it's at zero temperature, of course. At non-zero.
The problems come from the infrared mode, so you will only see it when you include enough of that. I think this is the easy picture.
Yeah, it has, but it has to be at zero temperature. Clearly, once you do the same at non-zero but small temperature, then you do not see that kind of behavior. The cusp appears only when the temperature is strictly zero. Again, that's the physics of metastable states, right? It can only occur when and be important when the temperature is exactly zero. Okay, so last piece is the phase diagram. In a region now, I mean, the other part of the diagram with the dimension in less than 4, and so all fixed points now have cusps, linear cusps, and we're in the breaking of dimensional reduction. For D larger than 4, one's fine is that there is a one cuspy fixed point which describes, again, the paramagnetic to ferromagnetic critical point. And, of course, that fixed point, as we said, can be obtained in the perturbative functional RG at one loop, and it's present above some critical value of the number of components. So it's only when the number of components is larger than 2.8347 and so on and so forth that you find indeed that kind of behavior. Now, when you're below 4 and below that value that we get also in the non-perturbative treatment because it gives back the one loop exactly, you find two cuspy fixed points. One which is the one unstable fixed point, and one fully stable function that describes a low temperature phase. And that one, the fully stable, which is non-trivial, has a cusp, describes the phase with the quasi-Lagrange order. So in that case, the whole low temperature phase, in a way, described by one non-trivial fixed point. Yeah, just done. and this one describes the critical transition between the two. And what you see here is that, just shown on the anomalous dimension, is that, of course, those two fixed points basically collapse at a given dimension. And that dimension now is the lower critical dimension of the quasi-Lagrange order phase. And that's for n larger than 1. Okay, this is 1.4 here, and you can go down, but this is for n. It has to be continuous symmetry. N equals 1 is, in that region, n equals 1 has still a ferromagnetic to paramagnetic transition. Okay, so it has to be continuous symmetry. Okay, so that's the way, and this curve here is basically the curves of the lower critical dimension, and that will be my last slide, is that on the diagram now, on the part of low dimension, so the physical part of it, is that, so this is dimension 4, this is the critical value here. So again, the right part here, we have a transition, critical transition from paramagnetic to ferromagnetic. And in that region, I guess, it has breakdown of dimensional reduction. Now, on the left part here, what you have is here, you have quasi-Lagrange order. That is, you have a transition from paramagnetic to quasi-Lagrange order behavior at low temperature. And in that region here, you have no phase transition at all. And this is the line that we find, you know, for the lower critical dimension. Now, just to give you an idea of the you know, the precision, in a way, of the calculation here, is that in d equals 2, we should be at n equals 1. And the approximation gives n equals 1.15. Okay, so that's about, you know, an idea of how bad it can be it's 10-15% error in here. In here, of course, it's exact, and this is the curve that one obtains that from the two-loop calculation that goes in this point here, and the tangent here is infinite. Anyhow, that means that this is the curve, and this is of course the point which is of physical interest, which is the xy in three dimension. And here we find that, and as we find also directly, that in fact there is no Bragg glass for this model, again, not for superconductors, but for this model. Okay, and that's the end of it. And thank you for your attention.
Before we get to questions, I just want to make a small remark to the Bragg glass issue, because I think it's relevant. So, then there will be some questions, but so you've got this D versus N thing, there is magic value of 2.8 here, and then you have N equal 2, which is the xy, right? And then you have N equal 2, one. So as you mentioned, this curve that you showed is the only thing which is.
Yeah.
But should go to this point, this is some kind of exact, let's say, likely result, and it should also start from here. And so the bias issue is this one here, right? Over this one here, also. Okay, so we find something like this. But we have actually, I know our college guy shares the same idea, but we have some idea that in fact, when you do the two loop calculation, you find actually, so what we need to do for the half spin model, so half spin means that on the continuum limit means that there are no dislocations, no topological defects. So then we actually expect for the half spin model, so without vortices, we expect the line to go around this point. This guy works with another, which Andreas has worked out and so on. And we know there are some non-critical dimension type of physics there, so it should go like this. So that should be for the hard spin. Now, you are doing some spin, so in principle you are looking for dislocations and the other things. And one possible scenario which could be tested by doing top calculation probably is, I mean, at the beginning these two lines should be essentially the same as Gina said. So it's absolutely possible that as long as dislocations are, topological boundaries are not relevant, these two lines should actually be the same and then potentially be circulated. So I just want to mention this because that's an alternative scenario. And only to get for physical boundaries is important to do more derivative expansion of the execution for the
well.
Questions? Why not?
No, I mean, okay. Just say that everything is possible. I just think that the derivative is go even at the two loop calculation to which we did. Okay, the derivative. In fact, when you look at the problem in n equals two, the lower critical dimension. Well, I mean that's a question of. Okay, if I just may just say one comment about this, is that indeed the problem here is how the massive mode come to kill the basically the quasi-long range order system. And I think that indeed this, and probably that's the point on which I agree with you, this is not universal. So for instance, if you take the random anisotropy system that I didn't mention here, the random anisotropy system, the NC is not 2.83, it's 9.5. And it goes down again to this point. And it has the same quasi-long range order system. So we haven't quite finished the calculation. But it is possible that for the random anisotropy that has the same phenomenology, either the curve that we get is here, or maybe the curve that we get is here. So clearly the fact that the lower critical dimension is here rather than here, or here, or here, is something which is non-universal. You can take the random field, the XY model, with random fields of different periodicity now. And with the periodicity, one knows that, you know, this is the periodicity one, but when other periodicities, they know that you indeed go to this point. So my feeling is that indeed this is not completely understood, is that the existence of the Bragg glass in here and the way it's killed by the massive modes might be in fact model dependent.
Okay, one question.
Does one know anything about the slope of this curve at n equals 1 and d equals 2 from other results?
N equals 1.
No, it should go in principle through n equals 1 and d equals 2.
Well, in principle.
Is there anything known about the slope?
No.
Okay, no questions. So we can move to next. So we have a 5-minute break. Thank you again.